Hi everyone, I'm Chris Aldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're speaking to three guests about K-12 school infrastructure and facilities. Our first guest is Dr. Jeff Vincent. Jeff is co-founder and director of the Center for Cities and Schools at the University of California, Berkeley, where he studies how school facilities serve as educational and neighborhood assets. He's also the co-author, along with Eric Bruner and David Schwegman, of the article, How Much Does Public School Facility Funding Depend on Property Wealth? Jeff, thanks for being on this month's podcast. So how does school infrastructure spending work? Is it a mix of local, state, or federal revenues, or how does all that come together?
Well, the thing to understand about school facility funding and school facility infrastructure funding is that it's overwhelmingly local. Local school districts across the country really raise the vast majority of money to build new schools, to upgrade and modernize existing schools. You know, that presents a structural challenge, right? Because each district is kind of situated in a different community. Those communities have kind of different characteristics and different wealth and different ability to tap into local resources, you know, and they namely do that through some local taxes or local bonds to raise dollars to upgrade their facilities or build new ones. And so you really have an unequal playing field in terms of school districts raising dollars for their facilities.
So I imagine every state, like everything else, does infrastructure facility spending completely differently than all of the others. So if you can, what's sort of a national picture of infrastructure spending right now?
Well, one thing that's really interesting about school facility infrastructure is that if you look at spending in this area nationally, right, these are public dollars being spent on public school facilities. It is the second largest sector of public infrastructure spending out there, behind transportation, of course. Everybody knows that's number one, right? But nobody knows that actually school facilities are number two. And I think that's because, you know, we have about roughly 100,000 schools, public schools across the country, right? So these are relatively smaller projects, right? They're not like a major bridge or the big dig in Boston or something of that nature, right? I mean, there's still lots of money and they can be, you know, tens of millions of dollars. But I think because the projects themselves are kind of relatively smaller than when people think of kind of quote unquote infrastructure, right? You know, I think that reality of just the sheer magnitude of this sector, I think is always really surprising to people. And I always like to kind of tell them that, like, wow, this is a big sector. And it touches so many people nationally. Like if you look across the country and you take all the public school enrollment from K through 12, and you add in all the staff in all of those schools, you know, about 1/6 of Americans go to a public school building, you know, every weekday in the U.S. I mean, that's a staggering number of people, right? So it's the sheer just size of the sector is huge. And if you look at the money that is raised and spent on public school facilities, you know, like I said before, it's overwhelmingly local. And so the national average on that is that local school districts raise 77% of the capital infrastructure dollars that are spent on their public school facilities, while states contribute on average 22%. And that remaining 1% comes from the federal government, and it's actually less than 1%, and it largely comes through FEMA in the event of, you know, an emergency where a school gets damaged or wiped out. So you can see it's really skewed to a local responsibility.
So let me go back and ask you about the 1% that you mentioned. There's been a lot of talk about a federal infrastructure bill. Is any of that money going to schools? And if so, how is it designed to fund school facilities, if at all?
Well, the short answer is no, not really. We had this infrastructure package move forward, and initially there was money for school facility upgrades in that. And it really came from what was written into the Rebuild America School Act, which passed the House and was introduced by Bobby Scott from Virginia. And it called for $100 billion in federal funds to upgrade kind of the worst condition schools in low wealth communities across the country over, I think it was a 10-year period. And ourselves and others kind of around the country kind of advocating for, we need better school facility conditions for our students and teachers, was really making the case over the last few years to have, for a federal role in school facility funding, but in particularly with the opportunity with this infrastructure package to say, hey, there's a lot of school facilities out there. The sector is huge, but there's really not enough money being spent. And so we have too many schools that are really in really subpar and really bad conditions physically. And so, we were making the case for a federal role. And, while it was initially in this federal infrastructure package, it didn't end up being included. Now there is some talk of including it in the reconciliation bill, although, as we've seen, in recent weeks, a lot of the debate around that, the amounts and things, for different topics have been reduced. And actually, as we speak, it really does remain to be seen if there will be even a little bit of money for school facilities. I hope that there will be, even if there's funds for the U.S. Department of Education to be more of a supporter to local districts and the states on this issue, or direct, grants to some of the districts that need kind of the most help in their school facilities. So we're hopeful, but it really remains to be seen. It's kind of an ongoing story.
If there was one thing that you could wish for on your infrastructure spending Christmas list, what would you ask for? What would you tell policymakers?
I think what's key here is that there really should be a local, state, and a federal partnership on this very important infrastructure. And while that partnership may still rely very heavily on local funds, it needs appropriate roles for the state and the feds to help out, particularly to ensure equity in conditions across communities and across schools. And so, and I think that's where we're kind of stuck now, is that we don't really have kind of a solid and robust partnership that kind of has the appropriate roles for these entities, right? So, if you look at if you look at all of public education funding in the US, right, that funds school operations and instruction, right, the non-facility stuff, local districts and states basically share in about a 50, 45% contribution on that. And then the federal government contributes about 10% of that total every year. It's through Title I and other things, right? But it's a 10% kind of presence or federal support. And really that's in the name of equity, right? Particularly districts that are more disadvantaged, get some federal dollars to help them. And so if you look at that, right, 45%, 45%, and then 10% from the feds, that's very different than what you see on the school facility side. Right. On the school facility side nationally, you see, as I said, 77% local, 22% state, and then less than 1% from the federal government. And so I guess to your question, what would be my holiday wish list would be, can we get some parity on that across on the facility side of things, just like we have on the education operating side. So it would be, more of a shared state and local responsibility. And then a small but appropriate role for the federal government, particularly to ensure that we have equity in school facility conditions, right? That all schools, even those attended by, the lowest income children, have healthy indoor air quality, have the technology they need for the curriculum, have science labs to teach the curriculum in the grades that they're in, et cetera. So, and we don't really have that from in every school. And so, I guess that would be. That'd be a good start to a good wish list or a good holiday gift.
Our second guest this month is Dr. Julian LaFortune. Julian is a research fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, where he researches education finance, school capital funding policy, and educational tracking and stratification. He is also the co-author, along with David Schoonholzer, of the article Do School Facilities Matter? Measuring the Effects of Capital Expenditures on Student and Neighborhood Outcomes. Julian, thanks for being on this month's podcast. So, let me start by asking you, I know a fundamental question in the economics of education is whether increased spending on schooling has a positive impact on student academic outcomes. So in your research, what have you learned specifically about the relationship between infrastructure spending and student achievement and performance?
In general, it's a difficult question to study, more difficult than, say, current expenses, you know, on teachers and other educators and support services, because school infrastructure and facilities are large investments that we spend a lot of money on upfront and then produce benefits over time, over several years, decades in many cases, if we're talking about a new school building. And so we need a long time frame to study often. And then, you know, new buildings don't come as often in general. And so we don't really have what's kind of referred to in the, you know, causal effects world as a natural experiment or a quasi experiment to try to tease out, you know, some sort of change that looks like it's, you know, plausibly random and not related to some underlying conditions that are going on, to really look at, you know, tease out the individual effect, say, of a new building or investments in infrastructure on student outcomes. But we do have some studies that look at this directly. And so I think, you know, in general, the research has found mixed results. So some kind of null findings and other more positive effects. And I think the more positive effects have been found in research you know, that I've done in Los Angeles Unified with a co-author, and then others have done in New Haven, Connecticut, looking at district-wide construction booms where they build many new schools at once, kind of a large influx of money, which you can almost think of as kind of a natural experiment after decades of not spending money on buildings. They replace, you know, several dozens, and in Los Angeles cases, hundreds of new buildings and construct hundreds of others. And then the second set are from kind of close, often statewide studies looking at close bond elections. That's where a lot of construction dollars are funded, new construction and new infrastructure dollars. And so if you look at kind of close elections, places that just pass or just fail a close bond, and what's kind of called in research lingo or regression discontinuity, but it's basically a difference between places that are, you know, 50.1% versus 49.9% just on that margin of passing or failing. And so they're kind of, you know, in a certain sense, very similar districts, but one gets a lot of additional funding. And those have tended to find, you know, smaller to maybe no impacts on test scores. And so really a lot of this research is on things like test scores, sometimes graduation, but the effects are somewhat mixed. And I think, you know, part of the reason for this is that when we look at the district level, you know, these studies that are kind of statewide and looking at bond elections, it's hard to identify what school got the investment. So even if it's a large bond and that, you know, adds up to $1,000 or $2,000 per student, you know, investment in that year, next year or two in new construction, that may all be at one school. And if that's, say, at a high school in the district, just one high school, you know, if we're looking at elementary and middle school test scores, then, you know, of course, we wouldn't pick up anything there. And so on average, you know, district level averages can give us some sense of what's going on, but we don't really have the statistical power when we kind of look at, you know, district-wide changes, because really what we would expect would be kind of small changes if you just look at district averages, because it's something that only affects a subset of students. So there are some meta-analyses that kind of pool together these studies and tend to, you know, which suggests more positive findings. But, you know, I think overall the literature is pretty mixed, and, you know, some of these kind of studies that I've been a part of and others looking at specific districts that have found more positive effects could also suggest it's not just an issue of, say, you know, statistical power or precision, but one of, you know, what places are really in need and what types of facility spending and infrastructure spending are maybe the most beneficial for students, right? You could imagine a place that's very, you know, dilapidated or overcrowded and has had kind of longstanding issues. We get kind of more bang from our buck there, so to say, than a place that has been, you know, well-resourced and is perhaps looking to, you know, add additional you know, amenities for students, or kind of a, you know, performing arts center, athletics campuses and facilities and so forth.
So you mentioned this a bit, that you looked at LAUSD. So what was it about LAUSD that allowed you to answer the question?
So a bit of background. So Los Angeles Unified had a lot of new school constructions and a lot of new infrastructure investment in the 40s and 50s in particular, especially in the post-war period. It was accommodating large enrollment growth. There was the baby boom. There were a lot of people moving to California and LA specifically in that time. So there was a lot of growth. The 60s and 70s then saw some enrollment declines, which is in part due to kind of the end of the baby boom in that period, and then also in part due to people moving to nearby suburbs. And then what was interesting is that, or I guess, interesting from a research perspective, unfortunate to the students who moved in, was that over the 80s and 90s, there was a large increase in enrollment. So going from around, 550,000 students in Los Angeles, it's a large district even then in 1980, to over 700,000 by the turn of the century in 2000. I mean, this was mostly driven by increased immigration and a growing share of Hispanic students, especially in kind of the east side of Los Angeles. And despite the fact that there was this large enrollment growth, the district really didn't build new schools in this period. And so there wasn't a lot of investment into new infrastructure to accommodate this growth. And so what you had are a lot of students that were moving in or kind of entering schools in LAUSD, especially in the 1990s, that were in many cases, decades old, kind of well past their useful life, had, been poorly maintained and were in poor condition and were severely overcrowded. So a lot of schools actually operated, they're so overcrowded, they operated on what's called a multi-track calendar. And so they had students kind of, there wasn't a traditional summer break. Instead, they had the school operate year round and they kind of rotated students, 8 weeks on, 2 weeks off to try to get the building to, go above its capacity. And so all of this is kind of background to basically an episode in the starting in 1998 and then continuing in the early 2000s where there's kind of a groundswell of voter approval to pass a lot of bonds, to pass a significant amount of funding to help improve conditions in Los Angeles. And so they spent and authorized over $25 billion in new school construction and modernization funding from 1998 till basically just about now over the next, over those two decades, which adds up actually to one of the larger public infrastructure programs since the Interstate Highway, if you kind of look at those more holistically in the national context. So it's a big program. And so that's what we wanted to study. We have, decades of really not spending a lot on infrastructure. And then in a fairly short period, there were a lot of new schools that were constructed. And the new schools are give us a nice kind of research design to really look at the effects on students themselves. So we look specifically over a 10-year period from 2002 to 2012 at 144 new schools that were constructed. And we look specifically at students before and after. So we kind of follow their trajectory through the grade levels, looking at students that were switched into new schools due to where they lived. So essentially they're living at an address that gets rezoned into a new school zone when the new school gets constructed. And then we kind of compare their trajectories over time. And what we find is that after 4 years of time spent in a new school, students are doing a decent amount better on their English language arts school scores, so about 5% of a standard deviation. So that's a relatively modest but important effect. And then a larger effect on math scores, about 10% of a standard deviation. And then we also find large increases in attendance. So not just test scores, but students were attending school about 4 or 5 days more per average than they were at the schools that were kind of previously old and overcrowded.
So in addition to what students experienced, because that's amazing in itself, were there effects on neighborhoods and communities that surrounded those schools?
Yeah, so this is where it gets both more interesting and trickier from a research perspective. So we weren't able to directly observe many of the specific benefits to communities. But one thing we did look at that you can think of as kind of a summary measure is local house prices. And so in a similar fashion, kind of comparing, in this case, not students, but local neighborhoods that did and didn't receive new schools based on kind of those zones that were created, the catchment areas around the new schools, we can kind of look at house price trends in those areas relative to other nearby areas, so both similar houses in nearby areas, and even looking at the kind of change in sale price in the same house over time, kind of before and after a new school was constructed. And what we find is really in kind of the lead up to a new school, there was no kind of differential trend or no difference in the house price, which in an economic sense is interesting. If you kind of see a new school, that's under construction, you might expect people anticipate that this will provide some benefits and you see, some appreciation before that happens. It's really not what we saw. We saw, if anything, it kind of over the, you know, 2, 3, 4 years following the school actually being completed, so not just under construction, is when house prices kind of started to go up, and go up by about 6% on average, which ended up adding up in an expensive market like Los Angeles to a lot of funding, and actually, or a lot of real estate value, even more so than kind of the total cost of the program itself.
So you started our conversation by mentioning how challenging it is to answer this question because of the context that's involved in determining whether there will be an effect or not. So the condition of the buildings, for example. So if a policymaker was reading your research, or if you were having a conversation with them, what would you hope they take away from it?
Well, I really think there's two things here that I would stress. And the first is, you know, I mentioned that there's not necessarily a consensus in the research or that it's difficult to study. But one thing I think that's more clear from the research that's been done is that places that have substandard or even, you know, dilapidated facilities that are in poor condition, I think those are cases where the research is pretty strong about there being potentially large impacts across a variety of student outcomes that we can measure. And those, you know, are, I think those are kind of important investments to consider. But related to that point, and this is kind of, there's two aspects to this. Really, this kind of second point I want to make is that, you know, how do we get money to the places that need it? And how do we kind of design fiscal mechanisms that then support, both identify this need and then support places that don't, you know, maybe have access to as much local funding to try to raise the money? And that's, I think, where there's a policy challenge. And so, you know, these two aspects I mentioned, one is the fiscal capacity of a district itself. And so unlike current funding, where there are a lot of, you know, a lot of state funding goes in and tries to equalize differences across districts that have, you know, high or low income or high or low property wealth. For the most part in the United States, in just about every state, most funding for infrastructure comes from localities and comes from local governments, and particularly comes through property taxes. And so that means places with high local wealth are going to, you know, in general, spend more on their school facilities. And so, you know, state funding mechanisms can try to address that somewhat and maybe overcome some of those disparities. And in some states they do, but in other states they don't. They can actually exacerbate that. So some states, California is one of these that relies on matching grants. And so what ends up happening is you kind of have to have money to get money. And so it actually, you know, in some sense replicates or even kind of exacerbates for some parts of the program, exacerbates these inequities that are kind of based on district wealth. And then, you know, a second aspect there is that's, you know, about the fiscal capacity, but that's not everything. You know, a lot of this is, you know, what we're thinking about, where should we invest and how much should we invest and where are the places we should invest first? It's really about what the need is in terms of the, you know, the infrastructure itself. And that's something, you know, I'm not sure what the situation is in Colorado specifically, but that's something in a lot of states and nationally where we just don't have good data to really ascertain. And there isn't kind of systematic, you know, statewide kind of policy or data collection that really tries to assess, you know, what is the state of our capital stock and where should we kind of put these first dollars in? And so I think this is something that perhaps mixed results in prior studies are speaking to. You know, some investments have very large return and others perhaps are more marginal. And I think there are a lot of places based on, you know, some of the survey data we have on school conditions that where, you know, students are attending schools in poor conditions. And so kind of the challenge is, you know, getting money to these places, designing mechanisms that kind of overcome, you know, both these local disparities in wealth and then also kind of identifying really the places that have the most need and targeting the funding to them, because that's, I think, what the research suggests, that those are really where the money is going to have the largest impact.
Our final guest this month is Kathy Gephardt. Kathy is a school board member on the Boulder Valley School Board in Colorado and a leader in both the Colorado Association of School Boards and the National Association of School Boards. She is also an attorney and adjunct professor who teaches education law at the University of Colorado Boulder and University of Denver, and she is one of the co-founders of Colorado's Building Excellent Schools Today program. Kathy, thanks for being on this month's podcast. Colorado has the Building Excellent Schools Today program, or BEST program. So what is the program and what problem is it trying to address?
So the Building Excellent Schools Today program is a grant program that started in 2008. And it was meant to address the fact that Colorado gives no general fund support to facilities. And so a lawsuit was brought in 1997 to address that issue called the Giardina versus State of Colorado. settled in 2000. And after 8 long years of negotiating with the legislature, we were finally able, with the help of Speaker Romanoff, to come up with a program called the BEST program, which, as I said, is a grant program primarily intended to help low property wealth school districts through the grants be able to either significantly renovate or build new schools. It was also meant to address a very longstanding need in Colorado. At the time, one of the other benefits of BEST is it did a first ever building survey of all of the school buildings in Colorado and found the need for school buildings to be somewhere north of $14 to $15 billion.
So you mentioned that survey. Is that how Colorado keeps track of what buildings are in need of repair over time? Does it get updated?
It's being updated, but it was never intended to actually identify buildings like from worst to best, no pun intended. So because the states never wanted to have a list like that, because I think it feels like it would then have responsibility to do something to fix the worst schools. So what they try to do, because the program's always been chronically underfunded, is as schools apply for grants, to have evaluators go out and update what the schools look like from the 2008 review. And so, and they're doing it on a rolling basis. So they're not only picking up the schools that apply for grants, but they're also trying to just renew and review other evaluations.
I know it's always a loaded question, but has it worked?
Depends on, as you know, how you would define has it worked. I think that people think of it as a successful program because we're able to harness local wealth, even when it's very limited, along with non-general fund revenue. So it's funded, we like to somewhat jokingly say that best schools are funded by fracking, gambling, and marijuana, because those are the three sources of revenue for it. And we're actually, we've gone a long way with just those three limited sources of revenue. There's never been any general fund contribution, and we're actually approaching the end of the line for those kinds of dollars for anything other than small cash grants. So if you're a district that has been able to get in before the money runs out, I would say you feel like it has worked. If you're a district that has not and still has outstanding needs, I think it's a little scary. And the state still continues to deny that it has any responsibility to make sure that our students and our staff are in safe buildings. And as an aside, it's even more important these days, especially looking at indoor air quality issues, because a lot of these buildings have failing HVAC systems. A lot of these buildings have no ability to actually upgrade those. And as we all know, with COVID and now not just COVID, but flus and colds and all that, indoor air quality has become something that's really important. And so we need to address those issues in addition to the structural issues.
So that's a perfect segue to my last question. So if you could send a message to policymakers, whether it be federal policymakers, state policymakers, local, what would it be?
So we are in receipt of, as all the states are across the country, one-time dollars from the federal government. Now, they're one-time dollars stretched out over a couple of years, but they're still one-time dollars that many people do not want to use for ongoing salaries or ongoing programs for fear of how do we continue to fund those programs or those salaries when the dollars run out. I would suggest to those policymakers that facilities is an ideal place to put one-time dollars. And I have talked with our federal legislators, I've talked with our local legislators, and I don't think anybody is against it, but there's just so much need out there that it's really hard to keep this issue elevated so that people actually are willing to address it. So I would encourage our policymakers, as they look at school funding and school issues across the state, to not ignore facilities. Because as I said, for so many reasons, including the quality, indoor air quality, and just the quality of the facility, it really does have an impact on education. As luck would have it, Chris, on my way up here, I ran into a superintendent who is a recipient of a BEST grant. And she said, you know, I went into another school because they're looking at expanding their school. And she said, space really does matter. It really helps with culture. It really helps with teaching. It helps with the overall education program. And people don't remember that, but the quality of the space really matters. And when you're talking about a new building in a rural school district where it's the heart and soul and bloodline of those communities, you're not just helping those families who attend the school, but you're helping whole communities. And I think that gets lost too. So, and that's even true in bigger cities, because, you know, your neighborhood school is where you go. for a lot of events. So I just hope that people remember how important facilities are and that it's really a good long-term investment.
Thank you again, Jeff, Julian, and Kathy for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPCTweets.